Okay, our next case is In Re Interest of Jokin. Yes, please, thank you. Again, this is In Re Interest of Jokin.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Katie Jedlowski, Assistant Public Defender, on behalf of Jokin's father, Devin. There's two central concepts in this case that we challenged on appeal: the burden of proof and the authority of the court to enter dispositional orders. In this case, the state did not meet its burden of proof, and the juvenile court erred in finding otherwise. The juvenile court's finding that Jokin was at risk of harm due to the habits or faults of his father is inconsistent with the record in this case. And then, following that adjudication hearing, the court imposed a plan of rehabilitation to include provisions that were unreasonable. First, as to the issue of the burden of proof, the state filed a petition in January of 2018, making certain allegations and enumerating certain conditions that it believed qualified the child in this case to come into the juvenile court's jurisdiction. And then in May of 2018, the trial was held regarding those matters enumerated in that petition. Ultimately, the court found that counts 1A, 1C, and 1D of that petition were true by a preponderance of the evidence, and thus holding that Jokin came within the meaning of the juvenile court's jurisdiction. Now, the three witnesses that testified in that matter, Valentine, Galindo, and Holt, their testimony essentially goes to and asserts the varying levels of compliance the father had in the months leading up to the state's filing of the third supplemental petition in January of 2018. Essentially, his compliance with drug testing, visitation services, and then also his general compliance with the caseworker and case objectives. Now, there were certainly times, and it's clear throughout the record, that he did not fully participate in the services.
Really at fairly critical times. In fact, when the hearing on September 6, 2017 occurred, he was going to have an opportunity to have overnight, unsupervised visitation with Jokin. As long as he complied with the drug testing and the visitation, and based on the record, from September to October, all of September, he didn't do any of the drug testing, right?
That's true, yes. The drug testing, I would say, is the biggest barrier of noncompliance.
Yeah, and that's the main reason that action was brought to begin with, is his problem with drugs.
Yes. So it initially came in for an isolated incident of drug use, and then he did have an opportunity in the fall of 2017. They were trying to set him up for success and so that Jokin could be home. And unfortunately, he was unable and did not fully comply with drug testing. What I think is critical, though, is that when he did participate, he was clean. And obviously, with various drugs, you're going to test clean at different times depending on when your last use was.
And so when you don't go into test for a month, it causes concern, rightfully, for the people working on this case that maybe he wasn't clean during that month.
And I think that's a fair assessment. I do think, though, because he was participating in visitation during overlapping periods where he wasn't drug testing, I didn't see from my review of the record that there was any indication when he was involved in parenting time with his child that there was a concern that he was high or impaired or under the influence during that parenting time. So while there's certainly, because he didn't always show up for testing or the testing provider was unable to come to him on the given day that he was supposed to be there, there's no scientific, in a sense, evidence that he was clean. But anecdotally, based on the supervised visitation reports, he participated in parenting time in those overlapping periods where visits largely went well and that he was able to adequately provide for his child's needs. He was able to do the feedings as were required with the additional medical attention in this case. He was engaged with him. I think it's clear from the reports that there's certainly a connection there, that there's a level of engagement there, and there wasn't the concern from that outsider's perspective who was then authoring reports about what they observed those conditions to be, that he was using at that time. So I think we're looking at an isolated incident of drug use, which doesn't mean he hasn't since, but you're looking at over a year. The times he did test, he was clean, and then, unfortunately, he didn't take advantage of the opportunity that was given to him. Incredibly unfortunate and regrettable from his point of view, certainly. But he did maintain that contact with this child up until the point of the filing on January 2019. And while it may be concerning to caseworkers that they don't have that tangible, well, he's testing clean, he's still engaged with this child, and I don't think there's true evidentiary nexus between him not complying fully and essentially not at all with drug testing in that fall of 2018 and the required evidentiary nexus for a definite risk of harm. And again, I would just harp back to the visitation reports, and essentially they're highlighting that he is able to care for his child and he can adequately do so. While some visits were missed, the record is clear that visits were not ended because of an inability to care for his medical needs or because of safety risks. And so to me, that demonstrates he wasn't using and he was using his parenting time appropriately, and thus, even accepting that maybe there was still drug use, where's the risk of harm? I guess it's on this record, I don't think that burden to satisfy that evidentiary nexus has been satisfied.
You spent some time addressing your second argument, the dispositional order and its relation to the rehabilitation plan, please.
Yes. So the second issue I raised was the authority of the juvenile court essentially to enter dispositional orders. So even if this matter should have been adjudicated as the court determined, and obviously we're asking that the court change course on that, the juvenile court clearly has broad discretion to enter dispositional orders. That's clear in the law as it stands. However, once a plan for reunification has been ordered to correct the conditions underlying this the adjudication, the plan must be reasonably related to the objective of reuniting the parents with the child. So I think here the critical inquiry is, does the provisions of the plan tend to correct, eliminate, ameliorate the situation or condition in which the adjudication has been obtained under the Nebraska Juvenile Code? And in this case, I think the reasonableness of the rehabilitative plan certainly depends on the circumstances. In this case, I'm arguing particularly that three conditions aren't reasonable. Not necessarily that the whole thing on its face isn't, but the imposition of the domestic violence course, the chemical dependency evaluation, also the psychological evaluation. So I think the two inquiries as I look at it based on Nebraska law is whether the plan was designed to correct the underlying problems that required the state to intervene or why they justify intervening into this family, and then secondly, whether the plan was designed to further that goal of reunification. And so in this case, I think those three particular orders don't serve or satisfy those questions and aren't reasonable. I think as far as the domestic violence course being ordered, what we have is you get to a few weeks after the adjudication, the court report comes in, the court takes it up, there's a fairly vague assertion from the caseworker at the time that the mother of the child says there's been some maybe verbal and also on rare occasions physical violence in the home, and then you have the supervisor of the caseworker in court actually identify to the court that she thinks, from her opinion, that there's manipulation going
on. When though? At the dispositional hearing or at the adjudication hearing?
That was at the dispositional hearing in June of 2018, so following the adjudication hearing. So the first time, from my review of the record, that the domestic violence is coming up at all is at the dispositional hearing. And the court has broad discretion to enter dispositional services, certainly as issues arise in a case, but in this case, I don't think there's at all a tie, or this information hasn't been corroborated by anyone. There's no firsthand knowledge of this type of behavior. And for the court then to insert itself and to impose an additional service in domestic violence courses, the reality is those are costly, time-consuming, and they are usually lengthy. And so when they impose services that aren't related to what's keeping a child out of home, they're preventing a parent from focusing their time, energy, and resources on the things that need to be addressed. And so I think it's concerning for the domestic violence piece to be ordered when all that is, from my review of the record, is a vague assertion from other parties that this is occurring, but we have no firsthand knowledge or corroboration
of it. So I'm going to interrupt you for a second. I understand your argument with regard to the domestic violence classes. What about the psychological assessment? Isn't there enough nexus between drug use and the need for an assessment to support that?
I don't believe there is. I would concede that typically drug use coincides with some sort of mental health issue. A lot of times they are intertwined. In this case, though, given the history of the drug use that we know in isolated incidents, and then also the fact that the father hasn't identified a mental health concern or a mental deficiency or any type of capacity issue, no one has, aside from aggressiveness, which I think is the state's position, there hasn't been some type of mental illness that's manifest itself in a way that people have observed. If we're ordering services, I think we need to be targeting at things. Why are we doing it? How is this manifesting? A psychological evaluation, they're just kind of casting a broad net, but to what end? And so again, that's another costly service that there's long wait lists for, and then to put a parent in that position when we're not even sure that there's something to address, you're just, maybe there is, unless there's something else manifesting to say there's a certainly something here that we need to try to figure out how are we going to treat it, how are we going to deal with it going forward. I don't think there's a strong enough connection there given the underlying facts of this particular case to impose the psychological evaluation at this point, which is not to say it wouldn't be appropriate down the road, but given the facts, I don't think there's strong enough evidence to impose it at this point.
Counselor, I know you're out of time. I just want to ask you one question back to the domestic violence. If the record were to support manipulation, is that a basis for requiring domestic violence classes?
If it...
Manipulation in itself.
I don't believe so. I would say no. I think even if you have a record that says you have a parent really inserting influence over another parent, and that's all it is, the domestic violence course, particularly the one used in Douglas County, is a batterer's intervention course that's 36 weeks long. That is something that goes way beyond a simple, addresses healthy, what they consider healthy relationships. A manipulation piece, I don't think, would satisfy or give enough of a reason to require a parent to do that absent other information that the court finds valid in the record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So it's my understanding we have a senior certified law clerk, is that correct? All right. You may approach. Before you start, counsel for appellant, we have a different name indicated for appearance today. It doesn't reflect that you signed in at the clerk's office, so if you haven't done so, can you do that and make an appearance here? State your name again here for the record.
Katie Jablowski.
Okay, thank you. And stop in the clerk's office and go ahead and sign in there.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. All right, sorry about that. You may go ahead.
No worries. I appreciate it, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is David Sarasso. I am a senior certified law clerk attending Creighton University Law School, appearing on behalf of Douglas County Attorney's Office. We represent the state in this matter.
And who is your supervising counsel here with you today?
That is Chanel Padavina.
Thank you.
No worries. Yes, Your Honor. My apologies.
That's right.
We pray this court affirms the findings made by the lower court that the minor child is within the meaning of Nebraska Revised Statute 43-247-3A, and that the rehabilitative services ordered at the dispositional hearing were appropriate to facilitate reunification between appellant and the minor child. The state proved the minor child comes within the meaning of subsection 3A by preponderance of the evidence, and that A, the appellant failed to engage in rehabilitative services, B, he failed to provide the proper parental care, support, supervision, and or protection for the minor child, and C, that the minor child is at risk for harm. The state proved by preponderance of the evidence, appellant failed to comply with the rehabilitative services ordered by the court on September 16, 2017, by proving that appellant did not participate in and cooperate with all visitation services, follow the recommendations of the chemical dependency evaluation, submit a random urine analysis within 12 hours of a request by the case manager, and maintain current contact with all parties to court, as well as NDHHS. Testimony abuse at the trial showed appellant failed to consistently participate in visitation services with the minor child. BBHS testified the state put on evidence that the appellant failed to visit with the minor child 66% of the time, that there was an occasion not to visit the child, or that an occasion occurred when the appellant did not visit the child in full, and that on in the month of January 2018, the appellant was placed on call status, to confirm status. However, appellant never called BBHS to confirm any appointments to arrange for visitation.
Did he know that he was on on-call status?
Yes. Testimony provided by the FPS worker stated that she personally informed him that he was going to be placed on call in the month of February 2018. So he was aware at that time that he was in need to take further active measures to arrange visits with his child.
Because he'd actually had fairly good attendance preceding that point. September of 17, 11 out of 13 visits. October of 2017, 12 out of 14. November, 12 out of 17, so it started to slide a little there. And then January of 18, that's where he really dropped off. It was 4 out of 12.
Correct, Your Honor. I believe, if I recall correctly, that it's because he was having communication issues with BBHS and not really providing notice or adequate notice as to why some visits were being canceled. And so I believe that is the reason why they were placing him on on-call status. Not so much that he was having visits with the child, but that it was more in fact that when he did cancel, there was no valid reasoning for it, with the exception of the medical excuses in which they did not need a valid reason. They just needed confirmation that he was sick.
Counselor, can we jump to the rehabilitative plan?
Yes, sir.
Sorry to throw you.
No, that's fine. I appreciate it.
Can you tell us, I'm looking at two particularly ones, the psychological evaluation requirement.
Yes, Your Honor.
What evidence was there to support the need for that?
The state would argue that because there is a ongoing pattern of drug abuse, as well as Exhibit 19 that was offered at the dispositional hearing, where the FPS worker wrote in her report that there was some concerns that the appellant was being manipulative. I would say that the psychological concerns as it pertains to the drugs and his manipulative behavior were evident.
Wasn't there something in the record that suggests he had not tested positive for drugs since like February of 2017?
Correct, Your Honor. He had not tested positive when he did test. There are numerous occasions, however, where the appellant failed to even either provide a sample, was unable to be contacted, or he did not arrange or meet with the testing worker to provide a sample. From my count, it was 23 missed tests between the agreed-upon stipulations and when the state filed the third supplemental petition.
So it's your position that he was manipulating the system a bit then?
Correct, Your Honor. I think he was avoiding as much interaction with the capstone workers as well as Owens and Associates to allege he was being compliant with the stipulated orders and to assert that he was in fact clean when, however, it's undetermined whether or not he was. From the testimony within the record, however, it was understood by the FPS worker that his failure to partake in any drug testing for whatever reason, unless there was an extremely valid rationale for it, was considered a positive test.
But to go back to Judge Reedman's question then, is that enough by itself, the fact that, you know, the case came up because of his drug use, and although he had not tested positive for a while because he was missing tests, is that enough then to require a psychological evaluation? How, you know, you're saying it's tied to the drug use. Is there authority to say that that's enough?
I don't have any authority to say to the court that it's enough. However, I will say that it is to the court's discretion to order rehabilitative services that they feel best suits the minor child's needs and which furthers reunification with that minor child and which will alleviate any risk of harm to that child. I think with the court taking notice of the record as a whole at the adjudication proceeding, as well as the new information and new exhibits or new evidence that came in at the dispositional hearing, the psychological evaluation was warranted, I don't want to speak for the court, but because of the drugs, the manipulation, and the ongoing history that the child, or that the appellant has with the court.
And is the reason for the domestic violence class, is that based solely upon the manipulation?
I wouldn't say I don't want to speak for the court again. However, I would definitely say that the report authored by the FPS worker heavily influenced it. But I would also say that the testimony by the guardian ad litem, as well as the FPS worker and the FPS worker supervisor, who testified that he was aggressive towards them and other workers, may have contributed to the domestic violence classes.
Isn't the problem here, though, isn't the court supposed to make findings of fact here after the dispositional hearing so that we can look at those and then relate it to the rehabilitative plan to make sure that there's a proper nexus? We're fishing to try and figure out why that's part of the rehabilitative plan, because we don't have findings of fact in this order. Isn't that true?
That is true, Your Honor. My understanding is that the rules of engagement are serving as a guidepost in dispositional orders or dispositional hearings, and I apologize if that's misstated, but that is my understanding of it. And so even though there's no evidence that is found true or found to be I would argue that the evidence that was received appropriately, and so therefore it should be taken into consideration that the court made an appropriate determination as to what services are appropriate for the
So even if there's not findings of fact in the order, if we can go back and see that there's enough evidence and relate it to the rehabilitative plan, that's all that's required of us, you believe?
I would assert so, Your Honor. Just for the simple fact that juvenile courts are intended to rehabilitate and to ensure that the minor child is safe. Because there are issues with, I don't want to say issues with the parent-child relationship, but there are pressing concerns going forward from the adjudication phase towards whether or not there is reunification or termination proceedings of the parent's custody or parental rights. I would argue that anything that comes in between those two fact-finding proceedings should be considered when ordering rehabilitative services.
I thought your comment was interesting just a minute ago, that about the evidence that suggests that he behaved in an aggressive manner towards some of the caseworkers.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I wondered about that when I saw that. It's like, well, is that a basis for a domestic violence class, that he's behaving aggressively towards medical personnel, towards the caseworkers, and then there's the evidence about manipulating the mother? So if the totality of that could be considered, you know, that's an interesting thought, but I question whether or not that was an appropriate consideration, the behavior towards the caseworkers and medical personnel in terms of a domestic violence class. What are your thoughts?
Because I don't know fully what domestic violence classes will entail versus a anger management class, I feel as though the court, instead of kind of maybe sentencing twice or punishing twice for maybe the same type of behaviors, because the underlying issue was with the appellant's mother, or I'm sorry, with the minor child's mother, that all the other acts of aggression are indicative of his behavior towards, in this case, women, but more specifically to the mother. And so there's other examples of where he's not really maintaining himself or composing himself as appropriate. And so the domestic violence classes would most address that issue without, like I said, kind of forcing him to do two types of classes that are addressing the same type of issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, the court, for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much for coming and arguing to us.
Thank you for having me.
Hopefully we weren't too hard on you.
No, I'm
sorry to take you off script.
No, it's fine. I appreciate it. And again, thank you for your guys' time.
Yes, thank you.
Support time.
Do we have rebuttal time? We're okay. Well, thank you both very much, and the matter is submitted.
Thank you.
Of course, if you can come over here, that would be great. Thank you. Oh, yes, thank you. So we have a conflict of interest on the last case of the day, and so Judge Reedman will be leaving.